visit, he had let the place shimmer with sunlight, and he could tell Caleb was impressed. They walked slowly through it, Caleb looking at the art and asking about different pieces, where he had gotten them, who had made them, noting the ones he recognized. And then they came to the bedroom, and he was showing Caleb the piece at the far end of the room, a painting of Willem in the makeup chair he had bought from Seconds, Minutes, Hours, Days, when Caleb asked, "Whose wheelchair is that?" He looked where Caleb was looking. "Mine," he said, after a pause. "But why?" Caleb had asked him, looking confused. "You can walk?" He didn't know what to say. "Sometimes I need it," he said finally. "Rarely. I don't use it that often." "Good," said Caleb. "See that you don't." He was startled. Was this an expression of concern, or was it a threat? But before he could figure out what he should feel or what he should answer, Caleb had turned and was heading into his closet, and he followed him, continuing his tour. A month after that, he had met Caleb late one night outside his office in the far western borderland of the meatpacking district. Caleb, too, worked long hours. It was early July, and Rothko would present their spring line in 8 weeks. He had driven to work that day, but it was a dry night, and so he got out of the car and sat in his chair under a street lamp until Caleb came down, talking to someone else. He knew Caleb had seen him. He had raised his hand in his direction, and Caleb had given him a barely perceptible nod. Neither of them were demonstrative people, and watched Caleb until he finished his conversation and the other man had begun walking east. "Hi," he said, as Caleb came over to him. "Why are you in your wheelchair?" Caleb demanded. For a moment he couldn't speak, and when he did, he stammered. "I had to use it today," he finally said. Caleb sighed and rubbed at his eyes. "I thought you didn't use it." "I don't," he said, so ashamed that he could feel himself start to sweat. "Not really. I only use it when I absolutely have to." Caleb nodded, but continued pinching the bridge of his nose. He wouldn't look at him. "Look," he said at last, "I don't think we should have dinner after all. You're obviously not feeling well, and I'm tired. I've got to get some sleep." "Oh," he said, dismayed. "That's all right. I understand." "Okay, good," said Caleb. "I'll call you later." He watched Caleb move down the street with his long strides until he disappeared around the corner, and then had gotten into his car and driven home and cut himself until he was bleeding so much that he couldn't grip the razor properly. The next day was Friday, and he didn't hear from Caleb at all. Well, he thought, that's that. And it was fine. Caleb didn't like the fact that he was in a wheelchair. Neither did he. He couldn't resent Caleb for not being able to accept what he himself couldn't accept. But then, on Saturday morning, Caleb called just as he was coming back upstairs from the pool. "I'm sorry about Thursday night," Caleb said. "I know it must seem heartless and bizarre to you, this aversion I have to your wheelchair." He sat down in one of the chairs around the dining room table. "It doesn't seem bizarre at all," he said. "I told you my parents were sick for much of my adult life," Caleb said. "My father had multiple sclerosis, and my mother, no one knew what she had. She got sick when I was in college and never got better. She had face pains, headaches. She was in a sort of constant low-grade discomfort, and although I don't doubt it was real, what bothered me so much is that she never seemed to want to try to get better. She just gave up, as did he. Everywhere you looked, there was evidence of their surrender to illness. First canes, then walkers, then wheelchairs, then scooters, and vials of pills and tissues, and the perpetual scent of pain creams and gels and who knows what else." He stopped. "I want to keep seeing you," he said at last. "But But I can't be around these accessories to weakness, to disease. I just can't. I hate it. It embarrasses me. It makes me feel, not depressed, but furious, like I need to fight against it. He paused again. I just didn't know that's who you were when I met you, he said at last. I thought I could be okay with it, but I'm not sure I can. Can you understand that? He swallowed. He wanted to cry, but he could understand it. He felt exactly as Caleb did. I can, he said. And yet improbably they had continued after all. He is astonished, still, by the speed and thoroughness with which Caleb insinuated himself into his life. It was like something out of a fairy tale. A woman living on the edge of a dark forest hears a knock and opens the door of her cottage. And although it is just for a moment, and although she sees no one, in those seconds dozens of demons and wraiths have slipped past her and into her house, and she will never be able to rid herself of them, ever. Sometimes this was how it felt. Was this the way it was for other people? He doesn't know. He is too afraid to ask. He finds himself replaying old conversations he has had or overheard with people talking about their relationships, trying to gauge the normalcy of his against theirs, looking for clues about how he should conduct himself. And then there is the sex, which is worse than he had imagined. He had forgotten just how painful it was, how debasing, how repulsive, how much he disliked it. He hates the postures, the positions it demands, each of them degrading because they leave him so helpless and weak. He hates the tastes of it and the smells of it. But mostly, he hates the sounds of it, the meaty smack of flesh hitting flesh, the wounded animal moans and grunts, the things said to him that were perhaps meant to be arousing, but he can only interpret as diminishing. Part of him, he realizes, had always thought it would be better as an adult, as if somehow the mere fact of age would transform the experience into something glorious and enjoyable. In college, in his 20s, in his 30s, he would listen to people talk about it with such pleasure, such delight, and he would think, "That's what you're so excited about? Really? That's not how I remember it at all." And yet he cannot be the one who's correct, and everyone else, millennia of people, wrong. So clearly there is something he doesn't understand about sex. Clearly he is doing something incorrectly. The first night they had come upstairs, he had known what Caleb had expected. "We have to go slowly," he told him. "It's been a long time." Caleb looked at him in the dark. He hadn't turned on the light. "How long?" he asked. "Long," was all he could say. And for a while, Caleb was patient. But then he wasn't. There came a night in which Caleb tried to remove his clothes, and he had pulled out of his grasp. "I can't," he said. "Caleb, I can't. I don't want you to see what I look like." It had taken everything he had to say this, and he was so scared he was cold. "Why?" Caleb had asked. "I have scars," he said, "on my back and legs and on my arms. They're bad. I don't want you to see them." He hadn't known really what Caleb would say. Would he say, "I'm sure they're not so bad," and then would he have to take his clothes off after all? Or would he say, "Let's see," and then he would take his clothes off and Caleb would get up and leave? He saw Caleb hesitate. "You won't like them," he added. "They're disgusting." And that had seemed to decide something for Caleb. "Well," he said, "I don't need to see all of your body, right? Just the relevant parts." And for that night he had lain there, half dressed and half not, waiting for it to be over, and more humiliated than if Caleb had demanded he take his clothes off after all. But despite these disappointments, things have also not been horrible with Caleb either. He likes Caleb's slow, thoughtful way of speaking, the way he talks about the designers he's worked with, his understanding of color and his appreciation of art. He likes that he can discuss his work about malpractice and Bastard, and that Caleb will not only understand the challenges his cases present for him, but will find them interesting as well. He likes how closely Caleb listens to his stories, and how his questions show how closely he's been paying attention. He likes how Caleb admires Willems and Richards and Malcolm's work, and lets him talk about them as much as he wants. He likes how, when he is leaving, Caleb will put his hands on either side of his face and hold them there for a moment in a sort of silent blessing. He likes Caleb's solidity, his physical strength. He likes watching him move, likes how, like Willem, he is so easy in his own body. He likes how Caleb will sometimes, in sleep, sling an arm possessively across his chest. He likes waking with Caleb next to him. He likes how Caleb is slightly strange, how he carries a faint thread of danger. He is different from the people he has sought out his entire adult life, people he has determined will never hurt him, people defined by their kindnesses. When he is with Caleb, he feels simultaneously more and less human. The first time Caleb hit him, he was both surprised and not. This was at the end of July, and he had gone over to Caleb's at midnight after leaving the office. He had used his wheelchair that day. Lately, something had been going wrong with his feet. He didn't know what it was, but he could barely feel them, and he had the dislocating sense that he would topple over if he tried to walk. But at Caleb's, he had left the chair in the car and had instead walked very slowly to the front door, lifting each foot unnaturally high as he went so he wouldn't trip. He knew from the moment he entered the apartment that he shouldn't have come. He could see that Caleb was in a terrible mood, and could feel how the very air was hot and stagnant with his anger. Caleb had finally moved into a building in the Flower District, but he hadn't unpacked much, and he was edgy and tense, his teeth squeaking against themselves as he tightened his jaw. But he had brought food, and he moved his way slowly over to the counter to set it down, talking brightly to try to distract Caleb from his gait, trying desperately to make things better. "Why are you walking like that?" Caleb interrupted him. He hated admitting to Caleb that something else was wrong with him. He couldn't bring himself to do it once again. "Am I walking strangely?" he asked. "Yeah. You look like Frankenstein's monster." "I'm sorry," he said. "Leave," said the voice inside him. "Leave now." "I wasn't aware of it." "Well, stop it. It looks ridiculous." "All right," he said, quietly, and spooned some curry into a bowl for Caleb. "Here," he said. But as he was heading toward Caleb, trying to walk normally, he tripped, his right foot over his left, and dropped the bowl, the green curry splattering against the carpet. Later he will remember how Caleb didn't say anything, just whirled around and struck him with the back of his hand, and he had fallen back, his head bouncing against the carpeted floor. "Just get out of here, Jude," he heard Caleb say, not even yelling, even before his vision returned. "Get out. I can't look at you right now." And so he had, bringing himself to his feet and walking his ridiculous monster's walk out of the apartment, leaving Caleb to clean up the mess he had made. The next day his face began to turn colors, the area around his left eye shading into improbably lovely tones, violets and ambers and bottle greens. By the end of the week, when he went uptown for his appointment with Andy, his cheek was the color of moss, and his eye was swollen nearly shut, the upper lid a puffed, tender, shiny red. "Jesus Christ, Jude," said Andy when he saw him. "What the fuck happened to you?" "Wheelchair tennis," he said, and even grinned, a grin he had practiced in the mirror the night before, his cheek twitching with pain. He had researched everything, where the matches were played, and how frequently, and how many people were in the club. He had made up a story, recited it to himself and to people at the office until it sounded natural, even comic. A forehand from the opposing player, who had played in college, he not turning quickly enough, the thwack the ball had made when it hit his face. He told all this to Andy as Andy listened, shaking his head. "Well," he said, "I'm glad you're trying something new. But Christ, Jude, is this such a good idea?" "You're the one who's always telling me to stay off my feet," he reminded Andy.
I know," said Andy.
"But you have the pool. Isn't that enough?
At any rate, you should have come to me after this happened."
"It's just a bruise, Andy," he said. "It's a pretty fucking bad bruise, Jude. I mean, Jesus."
"Well, anyway," he said, trying to sound unconcerned, even a little defiant, "I need to talk to you about my feet."
"Tell me."
"It's such a strange sensation. They feel like they're encased in cement coffins. I can't feel where they are in space. I can't control them. I lift one leg up, and when I put it back down, I can feel in my calf that I've placed the foot, but I can't feel it in the foot itself."
"Oh, Jude," Andy said. "It's a sign of nerve damage." He sighed. "The good news, besides the fact that you've been spared it all this time, is that it's not going to be a permanent condition. The bad news is that I can't tell you when it'll end, or when it might start again. And the other bad news is that the only thing we can do, besides wait, is treat it with pain medication, which I know you won't take." He paused.
"Jude, I know you don't like the way they make you feel," Andy said. "But there are some better ones on the market now than when you were 20 or even 30. Do you want to try? At least let me give you something mild for your face. Isn't it killing you?"
"It's not so bad," he lied, but he did accept a prescription from Andy in the end.
"And stay off your feet," Andy said, after he had examined his face.
"And stay off the courts, too, for God's sake."
And as he was leaving, "And don't think we're not going to discuss your cutting," because he was cutting himself more since he had begun seeing Caleb. Back on Green Street, he parked in the short driveway preceding the building's garage and was fitting his key into the front door when he heard someone call his name and then saw Caleb climbing out of his car. He was in his wheelchair and he tried to get inside quickly, but Caleb was faster than he and grabbed the door as it was closing, and then the two of them were in the lobby again, alone.
"You shouldn't be here," he said to Caleb, at whom he couldn't look.
"Jude, listen," Caleb said.
"I'm so sorry. I really am. I was just... It's been a terrible time at work. Everything's such shit there. I'd have come over earlier this week, but it's been so bad that I couldn't even get away. And I completely took it out on you. I'm really sorry."
He crouched beside him.
"Jude, look at me,"
he sighed.
"I'm so sorry."
He took his face in his hands and turned it toward him.
"Your poor face," he said quietly.
He still can't quite understand why he let Caleb come up that night. If he is to admit it to himself, he feels there was something inevitable, even, in a small way, a relief about Caleb's hitting him. All along he had been waiting for some sort of punishment for his arrogance, for thinking he could have what everyone else has, and here, at last, it was.
"This is what you get," said the voice inside his head.
"This is what you get for pretending to be someone you know you're not, for thinking you're as good as other people." He remembers how J.B. had been so terrified of Jackson, and how he had understood his fear. How he had understood how you could get trapped by another human being, how what seemed so easy, the act of walking away from them, could feel so difficult. He feels about Caleb the way he once felt about Brother Luke, someone in whom he had rashly entrusted himself, someone in whom he had placed such hopes, someone he hoped could save him. But even when it became clear that they would not, even when his hopes turned rancid, he was unable to disentangle himself from them. He was unable to leave. There is a sort of symmetry to his pairing with Caleb that makes sense. They are the damaged and the damager, the sliding heap of garbage and the jackal sniffing through it. They exist only to themselves. He has met no one in Caleb's life, and he has not introduced Caleb to anyone in his. They both know that something about what they are doing is shameful. They are bound to each other by their mutual disgust and discomfort. Caleb tolerates his body, and he tolerates Caleb's revulsion. He has always known that if he wanted to be with someone, he would have to make an exchange. And Caleb, he knows, is the best he will ever be able to find. At least Caleb isn't misshapen, isn't a sadist. Nothing being done to him now is something that hasn't been done to him before. He reminds himself of this again and again. One weekend at the end of September, he drives out to Caleb's friend's house in Bridgehampton, which Caleb is now occupying until early October. Rothko's presentation went well, and Caleb has been more relaxed, affectionate even. He has only hit him once more, a punch to the sternum that sent him skidding across the floor, but had apologized directly afterward. But other than that, things have been unremarkable. Caleb spends Wednesday and Thursday nights at Green Street and then drives out to the beach on Fridays. He goes to the office early and stays late. After his success with Malpractice and Bastard, he had thought he might have a respite, even a short one, but he hasn't. A new client, an investment firm being investigated for securities fraud, has come in. And even now he feels guilty about skipping a Saturday at work. His guilt aside, that Saturday is perfect, and they spend most of the day outdoors, both of them working. In the evening, Caleb grills them steaks. As he does, he sings, and he stops working to listen to him, and knows that they are both happy, and that for a moment, all of their ambivalence about each other is dust, something impermanent and weightless. That night they go to bed early, and Caleb doesn't make him have sex, and he sleeps deeply, better than he has in weeks. But the next morning, he can tell even before he is fully conscious that the pain in his feet is back. It had vanished, completely and unpredictably, 2 weeks ago, but now it's returned, and as he stands, he can also tell it's gotten worse. It is as if his legs end at his ankles, and his feet are simultaneously inanimate and vividly painful. To walk, he must look down at them. He needs visual confirmation that he is lifting one, and visual confirmation that he is placing it down again. He takes 10 steps, but each one takes a greater and greater effort. The movement is so difficult, takes so much mental energy, that he is nauseated and sits down again on the edge of the bed. "Don't let Caleb see you like this," he warns himself, before remembering Caleb is out running, as he does every morning. He is alone in the house. He has some time, then. He drags himself to the bathroom on his arms and into the shower. He thinks of the spare wheelchair in his car. Surely Caleb will have no objections to him getting it, especially if he can present himself as basically healthy. And this is just a small setback, a day-long inconvenience. He was planning on driving back to the city very early the next morning, but he could leave earlier if he needs to, although he would rather not. Yesterday had been so nice. Maybe today can be as well. He is dressed and waiting on the sofa in the living room, pretending to read a brief when Caleb returns. He can't tell what kind of mood he's in, but he's generally mild after his runs. Even indulgent. "I sliced some leftover steak," he tells him. "Do you want me to make you eggs?" "No, I can do it," Caleb says. "How was your run?"
"Good. Great."
"Caleb," he says, trying to keep his tone light, "listen, I've been having this problem with my feet. It's just some side effects from nerve damage that comes and goes, but it makes it really difficult for me to walk. Do you mind if I get the wheelchair for my car?" Caleb doesn't say anything for a minute, just finishes drinking his bottle of water. "You can still walk, though, right?" He forces himself to look back at Caleb. "Well, technically, yes, but..." "Jude," says Caleb, "I know your doctor probably disagrees, but I have to say I think there's something a little weak, I guess, about your always going to the easiest solution. I think you have to just endure some things, you know? This is what I meant with my parents. It was always such a succumbing to their every pain, their every twinge. So I think you should tough it out. I think if you can walk, you should. I just don't think you should get into this habit of babying yourself when you're capable of doing better.
Oh, he says.
Right. I understand.
He feels a profound shame, as if he has just asked for something filthy and illicit.
I'm going to shower, says Caleb, after a silence, and leaves. For the rest of the day, he tries to move very little, and Caleb, as if not wanting to find reason to get angry with him, doesn't ask him to do anything. Caleb makes lunch, which they both eat on the sofa, both working on their computers. The kitchen and living room are one large, sunlit space, with full-length windows that open onto the lawn overlooking the beach, and when Caleb is in the kitchen making dinner, he takes advantage of his turned back to inch, worm-like, to the hallway bathroom. He wants to go to the bedroom to get more aspirin out of his bag, but it's too far, and he instead waits in the doorway on his knees until Caleb turns toward the stove again before crawling back to the sofa, where he has spent the entire day.
Dinner, Caleb announces, and he takes a breath and brings himself to his feet, which are cinder blocks, they are so heavy and clunky. And watching them, he begins to make his way to the table. It feels like it takes minutes, hours, to walk to his chair, and at one point he looks up and sees Caleb, his jaw moving, watching him with what looks like hate.
Hurry up, Caleb says. They eat in silence. He can barely stand it. The scrape of the knife against the plate, unbearable. The crunch of Caleb biting down unnecessarily hard on a green bean, unbearable. The feel of food in his mouth, all of it becoming a fleshy, nameless beast, unbearable.
Caleb, he begins, very quietly, but Caleb doesn't answer him, just pushes back his chair and stands and goes to the sink.
Bring me your plate, Caleb says, and then watches him. He stands slowly and begins his trek to the sink, eyeing each footfall before he begins a new step. He will wonder later if he forced the moment, if he could have in fact made the 20 steps without falling had he just concentrated harder. But that isn't what happens. He moves his right foot just half a second before his left one has landed, and he falls, and the plate falls before him, the china shattering on the floor. And then, moving as swiftly as he'd anticipated it, there is Caleb, yanking him up by his hair and punching him in the face with his fist, so hard that he is airborne. And when he lands, he does so against the table, knocking the base of his skull against its edge. His fall makes the bottle of wine jump off the surface, the liquid glugging onto the floor, and Caleb makes a roar, and snatches at the bottle by its throat and hits him on the back of his neck with it.
Caleb, he gasps, please, please.
He was never one to beg for mercy, not even as a child, but he has become that person, somehow. When he was a child, his life meant little to him. He wishes now that that were still true.
Please, he says. Caleb, please forgive me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
But Caleb, he knows, is no longer human. He is a wolf. He is a coyote. He is muscle and rage. And he is nothing to Caleb. He is prey. He is disposable. He is being dragged to the edge of the sofa. He knows what will happen next. But he continues to ask anyway.
Please, Caleb, he says. Please don't. Caleb, please.
When he regains consciousness, he is on the floor near the back of the sofa, and the house is silent.
Hello?
He calls, hating the quaver in his voice, but he doesn't hear anything. He doesn't need to. He knows somehow that he is alone. He sits up. He pulls up his underwear and pants and flexes his fingers, his hands, brings his knees to his chest and back down again, moves his shoulders back and forward, turns his neck from left to right. There is something sticky on the back of his neck, but when he examines it, he's relieved to see it's not blood, but wine. Everything hurts, but nothing is broken. He crawls to the bedroom. He quickly cleans himself off in the bathroom and gathers his things and puts them in his bag. He scuttles to the door. For an instant, he is afraid that his car will have disappeared and he will be stranded, but it is there next to Caleb's, waiting for him. He checks his watch. It is midnight. He moves his way across the lawn on his hands and knees, his bag slung painfully over one shoulder. The 200 feet between the door and the car transforming themselves into miles. He wants to stop, he is so tired, but he knows he must not. In the car, he doesn't look at his reflection in the mirror. He starts the engine and drives away. But about half an hour later, once he knows he is far enough from the house to be safe, he begins to shake, so badly that the car swerves beneath him, and he pulls off the road to wait, leaning his forehead against the steering wheel. He waits for 10 minutes, 20, and then he turns, although the very movement is a punishment, and finds his phone in his bag. He dials Willem's number and waits.
"Jude," says Willem, sounding surprised. "I was just going to call you." "Hi, Willem," he says, and hopes his voice sounds normal. "I guess I read your thoughts." They talk for a few minutes, and then Willem asks, "Are you okay?" "Of course," he says. "You sound a little strange." "Willem," he wants to say. "Willem, I wish you were here." But instead he says, "Sorry, I just have a headache." They talk some more, and as they're about to hang up, Willem says, "You sure you're okay?" "Yes," he says. "I'm fine." "Okay," says Willem. "Okay." And then, 5 more weeks. 5 more. He wishes for Willem so intensely he can barely breathe. After they hang up, he waits for another 10 minutes until he finally stops shaking, and then he starts the car again and drives the rest of the way home. The next day, he makes himself look at his reflection in the bathroom mirror and nearly cries out in shame and shock and misery. He is so deformed, so astoundingly ugly. Even for him, it is extraordinary. He makes himself as presentable as he can. He puts on his favorite suit. Caleb had kicked him in his side, and every movement, every breath is painful. Before he leaves the house, he makes an appointment with the dentist because he can feel that one of his upper teeth has been knocked loose, and an appointment at Andy's for that evening. He goes to work. "This is not a good look for you, St. Francis," one of the other senior partners, whom he likes a lot, says at the morning management committee meeting, and everyone laughs. He forces a smile. "I'm afraid you're right," he says, "and I'm sure you'll all be disappointed when I announce that my days as a potential Paralympic tennis champion are, sadly, over."
"Well, I'm not sad," says Lucian, as everyone around the table groans in mock disappointment.
"You get plenty of aggression out in court. I think that should be your sole combat sport from now on."
That night at his appointment, Andy swears at him.
"What did I say about tennis, Jude?" he asks.
"I know," he says. "But never again, Andy. I promise."
"What's this?"
Andy asks, placing his fingers on the back of his neck. He sighs theatrically.
"I turned and there was an incident with a nasty backhand."
He waits for Andy to say something, but he doesn't. Only smears some antibiotic cream on his neck and then bandages it. The next day, Andy calls him at his office.
"I need to talk to you in person," he says. "It's important. Can you meet me somewhere?"
He's alarmed.
"Is everything okay?" he asks. "Are you all right, Andy?"
"I'm fine," Andy says. "But I need to see you." He takes an early dinner break, and they meet near his office, at a bar whose regular customers are the Japanese bankers who work in the tower next to Rosen Pritchard. Andy is already there when he arrives, and he places his palm, gently, on the unmarked side of his face. "I ordered you a beer," Andy says. They drink in silence, and then Andy says, "Jude, I wanted to see your face when I asked you this. But are you hurting yourself?"
"What?"
he asks, surprised. "These tennis accidents," Andy says. "Are they actually something else? Are you throwing yourself downstairs or against walls or something?" He takes a breath. "I know you used to do that when you were a kid. Are you doing it again?" "No, Andy," he says. "No, I'm not doing this to myself. I swear to you. I swear on Harold and Julia. I swear on Willem." "Okay," Andy says, exhaling. "I mean, that's a relief. It's a relief to know you're just being a bonehead and not following doctor's orders, which, of course, is nothing new, and apparently that you're a terrible tennis player." He smiles, and he makes himself smile back. Andy orders them more beers, and for a while they are quiet. "Do you know, Jude," Andy says, slowly, "that over the years I have wondered and wondered what to do about you? No, don't say anything. Let me finish. I do lie awake at night asking myself if I'm making the right decisions about you. There have been so many times when I was so close to having you committed, to calling Harold or Willem and telling them that we needed to get together and have you taken to a hospital. I've talked to classmates of mine who are shrinks and told them about you, about this patient I'm very close to, and asked them what they would do in my position. I've listened to all their advice. I've listened to my shrink's advice. But no one can ever tell me for certain what the right answer is. I've tortured myself about this. But I've always felt you're so high-functioning in so many ways, and you've achieved this weird but undeniably successful equilibrium in your life that I felt that, I don't know, I just shouldn't upset it, you know? So I've let you go on cutting yourself year after year, and every year, every time I see you, I wonder if I'm doing the right thing by letting you do so, and how and if I should be pushing you harder to get you help, to make you stop doing this to yourself." "I'm sorry, Andy," he whispers. "No, Jude," Andy says. "It's not your fault. You're the patient. I'm supposed to figure out what's best for you, and I feel I don't know if I have. So when you came in with bruises, the first thing I thought was that I had made the wrong decision after all. You know?" Andy looks at him, and he is surprised once more to see Andy swipe quickly at his eyes. "All these years," says Andy, after a pause, and they are both quiet again. "Andy," he says, wanting to cry himself, "I swear to you I'm not doing anything else to myself. Just the cutting." "Just the cutting," Andy repeats, and makes a strange squawk of laughter. "Well, I suppose, given the context, I have to be grateful for that. Just the cutting. You know how messed up that is, right? That should be such a relief to me?" "I know," he says. Tuesday turns to Wednesday, and then to Thursday. His face feels worse, and then better, and then worse again. He had worried that Caleb might call him, or worse, materialize at his apartment. But the days pass, and he doesn't. Maybe he has stayed out in Bridgehampton. Maybe he has gotten run over by a car. He finds oddly that he feels nothing. Not fear, not hate, not anything. The worst has happened, and now he is free. He has had a relationship, and it was awful, and now he will never need to have one again, because he has proven himself incapable of being in one. His time with Caleb has confirmed everything he feared people would think of him, of his body, and his next task is to learn to accept that, and to do so without sorrow. He knows he will still probably feel lonely in the future, but now he has something to answer that loneliness. Now he knows for certain that loneliness is the preferable state to whatever it was: terror, shame, disgust, dismay, giddiness, excitement, yearning, loathing, he felt with Caleb. That Friday he sees Harold, who is in town for a conference at Columbia. He had already written Harold to warn him of his injury, but it doesn't stop Harold from overreacting, exclaiming and fussing over him and asking him dozens of times if he is actually all right. They have met at one of Harold's favorite restaurants, where the beef comes from cows that the chef has named and raised himself on a farm upstate, and the vegetables are grown on the roof of the building, and they are talking and eating their entrees. He is careful to only chew on the right side of his mouth and to avoid letting any food come in contact with his new tooth. When he senses someone standing near their table, and when he looks up, it is Caleb, and although he had convinced himself he feels nothing, he is immediately, overwhelmingly terrified. He had never seen Caleb drunk in their time together, but he can tell instantly that he is, and in a dangerous mood. "Your secretary told me where you were," Caleb says to him. "You must be Harold," he says, and extends his hand to Harold, who shakes it, looking bewildered. "Jude?" Harold asks him, but he can't speak. "Caleb Porter," says Caleb, and slides into the semicircular booth, pressing against his side. "Your son and I are dating." Harold looks at Caleb, and then at him, and opens his mouth, speechless for the first time since he has known him. "Let me ask you something," Caleb says to Harold, leaning in as if delivering a confidence, and he stares at Caleb's face, his vulpine handsomeness, his dark, glinting eyes. "Be honest. Don't you ever wish you had a normal son, not a cripple?" For a moment, no one says anything, and he can feel something, a current, sizzle in the air. "Who the fuck are you?" hisses Harold, and then he watches Harold's face change, his features contorting so quickly and violently from shock to disgust to anger that he looks, for an instant, inhuman, a ghoul in Harold's clothing. And then his expression changes again, and he watches something harden in Harold's face, as if his very muscles are ossifying before him. "You did this to him," he says to Caleb, very slowly. And then to him, in dismay, "It wasn't tennis, was it, Jude? This man did this to you."
"Harold, don't,"
he begins to say, but Caleb has grabbed his wrist and is gripping it so hard that he feels it might be breaking. "You little liar," he says to him. "You're a cripple and a liar and a bad fuck. And you're right. You're disgusting. I couldn't even look at you. Not ever. Get the fuck out of here," says Harold, biting down on each word. They are all of them speaking in whispers, but the conversation feels so loud and the rest of the restaurant so silent that he is certain everyone can hear them.
"Harold, don't," he begs him. "Stop, please."
But Harold doesn't listen to him. "I'm going to call the police," he says, and Caleb slides out of the booth and stands, and Harold stands as well.
"Get out of here right now,"
Harold repeats. And now everyone really is looking in their direction, and he is so mortified that he feels sick.
"Harold,"
he pleads. He can tell from Caleb's swaying motion that he is really very drunk, and when he pushes at Harold's shoulder, Harold is about to push back when he finds his voice, finally, and shouts Harold's name, and Harold turns to him and lowers his arm. Caleb gives him his small smile then, and turns and leaves, shoving past some of the waiters who have silently gathered around him. Harold stands there for a moment, staring at the door, and then begins to follow Caleb, and he calls Harold's name again, desperate, and Harold comes back to him.
"Jude,"
Harold begins, but he shakes his head. He is so angry, so furious, that his humiliation has almost been eclipsed by his rage. Around them, he can hear people's conversations resuming. He hails their waiter and gives him his credit card, which is returned to him in what feels like seconds. He doesn't have his wheelchair today, for which he is enormously, bitterly grateful. And in those moments, he is leaving the restaurant. He feels he has never been so nimble, has never moved so quickly or decisively. Outside, it is pouring. His car is parked a block away, and he shuffles down the sidewalk, Harold silent at his side. He is so livid he wishes he could not give Harold a ride at all, but they are on the east side near Avenue A, and Harold will never be able to find a cab in the rain.
Jude, Harold says once they're in the car, but he interrupts him, keeping his eyes on the road before him.
I was begging you not to say anything, Harold, he says. And you did anyway. Why did you do that, Harold? You think my life is a joke? You think my problems are just an opportunity for you to grandstand?
He doesn't even know what he means. Doesn't know what he's trying to say.
No, Jude, of course not, says Harold, his voice gentle. I'm sorry. I just lost it.
This sobers him for some reason, and for a few blocks they are silent, listening to the sluice of the wipers.
Were you really going out with him? Harold asks.
He gives a single, terse nod.
But not anymore, Harold asks, and he shakes his head.
Good, Harold mutters, and then, very softly,
did he hit you?
He has to wait and control himself before he can answer.
Only a few times, he says. Oh, Jude, says Harold, in a voice he has never heard Harold use before. Let me ask you something, though, Harold says, as they edge down 15th Street past 6th Avenue. Jude, why were you going out with someone who would treat you like that?
He doesn't answer for another block, trying to think of what he could say, how he could articulate his reasons in a way Harold would understand.
I was lonely, he says, finally.
Jude, Harold says, and stops.
I understand that, he says. But why him?
Harold, he says, and he hears how awful, how wretched he sounds.
When you look like I do, you have to take what you can get.
They are quiet again, and then Harold says,
stop the car.
What? He says.
I can't, there are people behind me.
Stop the damn car, Jude, Harold repeats, and when he doesn't, Harold reaches over and grabs the wheel and pulls it sharply to the right into an empty space in front of a fire hydrant. The car behind passes them, its horn bleating a long warning note.
Jesus, Harold!
He yells.
What the hell are you trying to do? You nearly got us into an accident.
Listen to me, Jude, says Harold slowly, and reaches for him. But he pulls himself back against the window, away from Harold's hands. You are the most beautiful person I have ever met. Ever.
Harold, he says. Stop. Stop. Please stop.
Look at me, Jude, says Harold.
But he can't.
You are. It breaks my heart that you can't see this.
Harold,
he says, and he is almost moaning.
Please, please. If you care about me, you'll stop.
Jude,
says Harold, and reaches for him again, but he flinches and brings his hands up to protect himself. Out of the edge of his eye, he can see Harold lower his hand slowly. He finally puts his hands back on the steering wheel, but they are shaking too badly for him to start the ignition, and he tucks them under his thighs, waiting.
Oh, God,
he hears himself repeating.
Oh, God.
Jude,
Harold says again.
Leave me alone, Harold,
he says, and now his teeth are chattering as well, and it is difficult for him to speak.
Please.
They sit there in silence for minutes. He concentrates on the sound of the rain, the traffic light turning red and green and orange, and the count of his breaths. Finally, his shaking stops, and he starts the car and drives west and north up to Harold's building.
Come stay in the apartment tonight, Harold says, turning to him.
But he shakes his head, staring straight ahead. At least come up and have a cup of tea and wait until you feel a little better. But he shakes his head again.
Jude, Harold says, I'm really sorry. For everything. For all of it.
He nods, but he still can't say anything. Will you call me if you need anything?
Harold persists, and he nods again. And then Harold reaches his hand up slowly, as if he is a feral animal, and strokes the back of his head twice before getting out, closing the door softly behind him. He takes the West Side Highway home. He is so sore, so depleted. But now his humiliations are complete. He has been punished enough, he thinks, even for him. He will go home and cut himself, and then he will begin forgetting, this night in particular, but also the past 4 months. At Green Street, he parks in the garage and rides the elevator up past the silent floors, clinging to the cage door mesh. He is so tired that he will slump to the ground if he doesn't. Richard is away for the fall at a residency in Rome, and the building is sepulchral around him. He steps into his darkened apartment and is feeling for the light switch when something clots him hard on the swollen side of his face, and even in the dark, he can see his new tooth project itself into the air. It is Caleb, of course, and he can hear and smell his breath even before Caleb flicks the master switch and the apartment is illuminated, dazzlingly, into something brighter than day. And he looks up and sees Caleb above him, peering down at him. Even drunk, he is composed, and now some of his drunkenness has been clarified by rage, and his gaze is steady and focused. He feels Caleb grab him by his hair, feels him hit him on the right side of his face, the good one, feels his head snapping backward in response. Caleb still hasn't said anything, and now he drags him to the sofa, the only sounds, Caleb's steady breaths and his frantic gulps. He pushes his face into the cushions and holds his head down with one hand, while with the other, he begins pulling off his clothes. He begins to panic, then, and struggle, but Caleb presses one arm against the back of his neck, which paralyzes him, and he is unable to move. He can feel himself become exposed to the air piece by piece, his back, his arms, the backs of his legs. And when everything's been removed, Caleb yanks him to his feet again and pushes him away, but he falls and lands on his back.
Get up, says Caleb. Right now.
He does. His nose is discharging something, blood or mucus, that is making it difficult for him to breathe. He stands. He has never felt more naked, more exposed in his life. When he was a child and things were happening to him, he used to be able to leave his body, to go somewhere else. He would pretend he was something inanimate, a curtain rod, a ceiling fan, a dispassionate, unfeeling witness to the scene occurring beneath him. He would watch himself and feel nothing. Not pity, not anger, nothing. But now, although he tries, he finds he cannot remove himself. He is in this apartment, his apartment, standing before a man who detests him, and he knows this is the beginning, not the end, of a long night. One he has no choice but to wait through and endure. He will not be able to control this night. He will not be able to stop it.
My God, Caleb says,
after looking at him for a few long moments. It is the first time he has ever seen him wholly naked.
My God, you really are deformed. You really are.
For some reason, it is this pronouncement that brings them both back to themselves, and he finds himself, for the first time in decades, crying.
Please,
he says.
Please, Caleb. I'm sorry.
But Caleb has already grabbed him by the back of his neck and is hurrying him, half dragging him toward the front door. Into the elevator they go, and down the flights, and then he is being dragged out of the elevator and marched down the hallway toward the lobby. By now he is hysterical, pleading with Caleb, asking him again and again what he's doing, what he's going to do to him. At the front door, Caleb lifts him, and for a moment, his face is fitted into the tiny, dirty glass window that looks out onto Green Street, and then Caleb is opening the door, and he is being pushed out naked into the street.
No!
He shouts, half inside, half outside.
Caleb, please!
He is pulled between a crazed hope and a desperate fear that someone will walk by. But it is raining too hard. No one will walk by. The rain drums a wild pattern on his face.
Beg me, says Caleb, raising his voice over the rain,
and he does, pleading with him.
Beg me to stay, Caleb demands. Apologize to me.
And he does, again and again, his mouth filling with his own blood, his own tears. Finally, he is brought inside and is dragged back to the elevator, where Caleb says things to him, and he apologizes and apologizes, repeating Caleb's words back to him as he instructs.
I'm repulsive. I'm disgusting. I'm worthless. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
In the apartment, Caleb lets go of his neck, and he falls, his legs unsteady beneath him, and Caleb kicks him in the stomach so hard that he vomits, and then again in his back, and he slides over Malcolm's lovely, clean floors and into the vomit. His beautiful apartment, he thinks, where he has always been safe. This is happening to him in his beautiful apartment, surrounded by his beautiful things, things that have been given to him in friendship, things that he has bought with money he has earned. His beautiful apartment, with its doors that lock, where he was meant to be protected from broken elevators and the degradation of pulling himself upstairs on his arms, where he was meant to always feel human and whole. Then he is being lifted again and moved, but it is difficult to see where he's being taken. One eye is already swollen shut, and the other is blurry. His vision keeps blinking in and out. But then he realizes that Caleb is taking him to the door that leads to the emergency stairs. It is the one element of the old loft that Malcolm kept, both because he had to, and because he liked how bluntly utilitarian it was, how unapologetically ugly. Now Caleb unslides the bolt, and he finds himself standing at the top of the dark, steep staircase. So descent into hell looking, he remembers Richard saying. One side of him is gluey with vomit. He can feel other liquids. He cannot think about what they are, moving down other parts of him, his face, his neck, his thighs. He is whimpering from pain and fear, clutching the edge of the doorframe, when he hears, rather than sees, Caleb move back and run at him, and then his foot is kicking him in his back, and he is flying into the black of the staircase. As he soars, he thinks suddenly of Dr. Caution, or not of Dr. Caution necessarily, but the question he had asked him when he was applying to be his advisee. What's your favorite axiom? The nerd pickup line, CM had once called it. The axiom of equality, he'd said, and Caution had nodded approvingly. That's a good one, he'd said. The axiom of equality states that X always equals X. It assumes that if you have a conceptual thing named X, that it must always be equivalent to itself, that it has a uniqueness about it, that it is in possession of something so irreducible that we must assume it is absolutely, unchangeably equivalent to itself for all time, that its very elementalness can never be altered. But it is impossible to prove. Always, absolutes, nevers, these are the words, as much as numbers, that make up the world of mathematics. Not everyone liked the axiom of equality. Dr. Lee had once called it coy and twee, a fan dance of an axiom, but he had always appreciated how elusive it was, how the beauty of the equation itself would always be frustrated by the attempts to prove it. It was the kind of axiom that could drive you mad, that could consume you, that could easily become an entire life. But now he knows for certain how true the axiom is, because he himself, his very life, has proven it. The person I was will always be the person I am, he realizes. The context may have changed.
He may be in this apartment, and he may have a job that he enjoys and that pays him well, and he may have parents and friends he loves. He may be respected.